All right, for many of you, let me just give you a real quick 1 minute synopsis of what we're doing. We are doing this new series entitled God Is, and then we're saying God is these 8 or 9 different things. And our goal in doing this is not that, oh, we weren't talking about theology before and now we are, but our goal is rather to say, what difference is it going to make in our lives this week and going forward? And what difference is it going to make collectively as a church that emphasizes these attributes and names and characteristics of our God as he's revealed himself to us? I think of giving you a tool which is street level theology. That this is not a Sunday morning ghetto theology, but it's a street level theology that when you walk back to your jobs and your families and your marriages and your friendships and even your recreation and your relaxation and your vacation, that what we have to say and what we believe about God transforms all of that. And remember what we're trying to do. I use this example of different containers of Tupperware in the refrigerator, and you have different foods in each one, and those smells and those tastes don't mix because they're compartmentalized. And I fear that even as Christians, we too often have compartmentalized. Yes, do I believe these things about God? Absolutely. OK, what difference is that going to make Monday morning? I have no idea. It's just that compartment. And taking God out of that compartment and letting him be fully God and placing our lives into him and using our theology so our theology isn't useless. And this morning, that study brings us, this is our third week, to the idea, the attribute of God's sovereignty. And this morning, what I'd like to do is with 3 simple points. I'm going to begin with the meaning of God's sovereignty. And then I'm going to talk about, after you understand, OK, this is what it is. What is the basis or what is the ground of God even claiming to have that kind of sovereignty in my life and in your life and over this world that we see, that we live in? And then in closing, we'll walk out a couple implications or some applications of that together. Of what difference will that make now? OK, so the meaning of God's sovereignty, and this is very simple. If you looked up in a definition, you said, OK, what is sovereignty? As we're talking about saying that God is sovereign or he possesses sovereignty, a dictionary will just say it's the quality or state of having the supreme rank, power or authority. And just as our culture, pop culture, tends to use this word sovereignty or thinking of someone or something as sovereign over something, they think that means autonomy. You have the freedom to choose, the freedom to act. They think in terms of authority. They think in terms of power or someone or something having supremacy over someone else. And for sure, God has all of those things. He has autonomy. He is self-determining. God is not sitting there, you know, waiting for someone to hand him instructions on what to do. He's self-determining. He's self-governing. He's certainly preeminent. But as theologians have talked about what the Bible itself says about the sovereignty of God, there are 2 main things that I think really define and explain God's sovereignty. The first of those is God's sovereignty is his absolute right to do whatever he pleases. And by absolute, I mean unlimited. I mean without restrictions. This is the idea that as God prepares to act and then acts, he is not asking permission from anyone. He's simply acting without any limitation. And there are many verses that say this. One is Psalm 103, verse 19. The Lord has established his throne in the heavens and his kingdom rules over all. And then Psalm 115, verse 3 puts it in the broadest terms. Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Now, that can be a terrifying thing, depending on what you think of God. You think God sits in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. I mean, what's that about? Because I don't want God doing all that he pleases if God is like my toddler son. My toddler son also does all that he pleases, which may mean taking a marker and coloring on the wall or throwing his food around the kitchen. But if you bring that idea to God's pleasure is like, oh, so God's just like willy nilly just doing whatever he pleases. Well, no, because God's good pleasure is always shaped and guided by his character. And what that means is his good pleasure is not just, I think I'll go do something destructive like my toddler. But His will is always holy and good and righteous. And we can trust that when God says, I'm in the heavens, I'm doing all that I please, that what that means is I'm doing everything that I know to be good. So sovereignty refers to God's absolute, unrestricted freedom to do His own good pleasure. But then I think there's this second important piece, that it also refers to God's definite plan that leads to that end. Okay, so He has this pleasure, He has this will, but then He also, in real space-time history, in your life and in my life, He is doing lots of things simultaneously. He is multitasking to accomplish that pleasure. So the Apostle Paul puts it like this in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11. He says, we have been predestined according to the purpose of Him who works all things according to the counsel of His will. And again, you say all things according to the counsel of His will. I mean, what about the bad stuff in my life? What about the painful stuff in my life? What about the stuff that I don't want in my life? You're saying that God is working that according to the counsel of His will as well? Absolutely, I'm saying that. Because I think that's what Paul is saying. That's what Scripture is saying. And I think the most powerful illustration of the fact that when God says all things are working my plan, the most powerful example of that is the worst thing that ever happened to the best person. The crucifixion of Jesus. Because if the crucifixion of the only perfectly innocent man who ever lived can fall under God's purposes, then the bad stuff that's happening in your life and the bad stuff that's happening in my life falls under God's purposes, too. And I love that on that day of Pentecost, when the Apostle Peter stands up and he's preaching to the very people in Jerusalem who had just crucified Jesus days earlier, he says, you are guilty of murdering Jesus. And they're convicted by his words. But in the very next statement, he says this: Jesus was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. Now, are you still culpable? Are you still responsible for having done something evil and murdering Jesus? Yes. But did something happen to Jesus that God and Jesus himself as the Son of God, that was outside their plan and stuff got out of control? Jesus said one too many things pushing up against Rome or pushing up against the religious leaders and they got offended and flew off the handle and God says, uh-oh, what just happened? No. God ultimately sent his son to a cross because it was part of his divine plan to redeem the world. So that's what it means when we say God is sovereign. It means he does his good pleasure in all things, but then he's active here in history to actually walk that out. And maybe someone's sitting here thinking, well, that's awfully convenient that you believe that. I mean, you believe that about your Christian God, and the Muslims believe that about their God, and the Christian scientists believe that about their God, and the Mormons believe that about their God, and then, you know, maybe I'm atheist and I just don't believe that there's any God that's sovereign. So how would you prove that your God gets the right to do all the things that you just said versus somebody else's God? And I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a very solid answer to that in Colossians chapter 1. And this is what I'm referring to as the basis or the foundation of God's sovereignty. You know, and I understand that I'm speaking to you in a pluralistic and relativist society where we all say, just live and let live. Your beliefs are your beliefs. My beliefs are my beliefs. Don't worry about what other people believe. Let me have my thing. You have your thing. But I think at some point this has to stop with the idea of sovereignty, right? Because if someone or something is really sovereign, that means nothing else is. And it makes no sense whatsoever. It's self-contradictory to say that 2 or 3 or 10 or 1,000 different gods and idols and ideologies are all in control. This simply can't be true. If it is true, as Psalm says, that God sits in the heavens and does what he pleases, that means that no one else has that role. But what is the basis for Yahweh? That's the name of our God. What is the basis of Yahweh claiming I'm the one who bears that sovereignty? So now Colossians chapter 1. And I'm going to jump into the middle of something that the Apostle Paul is writing here. And I want you to understand that he's writing to Christians in a city or a town known as Colossae in the first century. And it was a city that was full of idols. And even more than that, it was a city, and I'm not sure, we don't know, kind of recreating the history and the culture of that city, fully what was going on. But we know that this particular city had fallen into this trap somehow of actually worshiping angels. They said, it's all divine. It's all supernatural. So you worship God, whatever his name is or her name is. And we have all these idols. And then some of the rest of us worship angels and pray to angels and expect angels to do miracles in our lives. And Paul is writing to them and saying, okay, you've asked this question of us, Epaphras, my friend that probably planted this church, and I, the Apostle Paul. You Christians say that we should turn from the idols and the angel worship and worship God alone and his son Jesus. And you're saying that we should trust him as the only sovereign. What gives you the right to say that? Why should we take your word for it? And I'll begin in verse 15. He says, because Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him, all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. Now, there may be more than this, but there's not less than this. Paul just gave you five bases that God, and especially in the person of Jesus, can say, I'm sovereign. Okay, number one, I'll call the nature element. You know why God gets to be in charge? You know why he's in control? Do you know why he has a plan for the ages and works everything according to that plan? The most simple answer is because he's God. We don't follow Jesus because we think, man, he was such a good man. He taught us about love. He said a lot of nice things before he ended up saying too much and getting himself killed. That's not why we love Jesus. That's not why we follow Jesus. We don't follow Jesus because we agree with him. We don't follow Jesus because he did miracles. Do you know why we follow Jesus? Do you know why we submit to the lordship of Jesus? It's right here. It's because he's the image of the invisible God. We follow Jesus because in him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Psalm 135, verses 5 and 6, we read this. The psalmist says, for I know that the Lord is great and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and on earth, in the seas and all deeps. And there's that idea again. He does whatever he pleases. But then he goes on in the same psalm and he sets up this contrast. This is verse 15 now. And he says, but the idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but do not speak. They have eyes, but do not see. They have ears, but do not hear. Nor is there any breath in their mouths. And what he's saying is you may make something with your own hands that looks like what you think a god should look like. That doesn't make it a god. And the difference between God, and this is a Trinitarian, Father, Son, and Spirit God, as we talked about last Sunday. The difference between that God and every other God is that this one actually, by eternal essence and nature, is God. And the other things that we've erected in our culture and erected in our own lives and said, that is a God to me, I worship that, I serve that, it doesn't make it a God. Abraham Lincoln used to have this question. If you call a dog's tail a leg, then how many legs does a dog have? If you call a dog's tail a leg, how many legs do you have? Everybody says five. And he says, no, because it doesn't matter what you call it. It's still his tail. And I think the same holds true of God, that just calling someone or something God doesn't make it God. There is something by nature that is a leg. There's something by nature that is a tail. There's something by nature that is God. And the foundation of our Christian theology is that the reason, the ultimate reason why God gets to be sovereign is because he's God and nothing else is. Now, a second reason I see here as a ground or a basis for God's sovereignty is what I'll call the time and logic element. And I call it time and logic because it may be one or the other, and I'm about to read this phrase for you, and you'll see what I'm talking about, or I think it's actually probably both. And I'm pointing you to the phrase in verse 17 where Scripture says that God is before all things. Now, does that mean chronologically he was there before all things? Yes, it does mean that, because God is eternal. So before anything else existed, God was there. He was first. But also logically, God was first, because nothing else could come into existence unless God was there. And I'll touch on that in just a moment. Some of you know Pastor Andy Stanley, North Point Church in the Atlanta area. And he always says, I'm not sovereign. I'm not the leader of this church because I'm smarter or I'm better or I've got better ideas than anybody else here. He says, I'm the leader of this organization because I got here first. We also think of this in terms of property rights. You know, our nation has had these different opportunities where it's like, you know, all this land is for sale. Whoever goes and, you know, buys this plot of land first, it's yours. And you have sovereign rights over the land that you first obtained. It's this idea, but more with God. He's before all things. Number three, the third basis of his authority is what I'll call the ownership element. And verse 16 puts it this way, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And if you ever want to know at the end of the day, why is God sovereign and no one else is, it's right here. It's because there was a time when nothing else existed except for God, and he called it all into existence. One theologian says everything that is not God has derived his existence from God. Why is God sovereign over the sun, the moon, the stars, and the distant nebula and all that? Why is God sovereign over this earth with its rocks and plants and trees and animals? Why is God sovereign over human life and human history? It's right here. Because everything owes its existence to God. We have some attorneys in our church, and you may even know this term, but in our culture, in our legal culture, we call it creator's rights or creator ownership. And we recognize this everywhere else, that if someone has authored something, you know, I've written a book or I've written a play, who does that belong to? Who's sovereign over that? The person who wrote it. You know, if I invent something, if I handcraft something, who is sovereign over that? The person that made it. Creator rights, creator ownership. And against that, I think we get that idea actually from what we understand of God. That the entire, and he says visible and invisible, which means physical and metaphysical universe belongs to God. He is the owner of it because all things were made by him and for him. And then he goes right on here in verse 17. That's verse 16. Why does God own it? Because he created it. But he goes on in verse 17 and said, and in him all things hold together. And that phrase tells us that God didn't simply create things and set them in motion and then say, OK, you know, keep revolving around the sun, keep spinning in orbit, keep doing your thing. I'm going to go do my thing. And he walks away. But this is a verse, this is a doctrine known as the sustaining work of God. That he didn't just put it out there, but he continues to actively sustain it. Or Hebrews 1, I think verse 3 says, not only did God create the world, but by the word of his power, he holds it together. Now, I don't suggest to you that when the apostles were writing these words in Colossians and in Hebrews, that they understood subatomic particles, because they didn't. OK, so that would be anachronistic to say what Paul meant was this isn't what Paul meant, but here's an illustration of what Paul meant. OK, if you go to the subatomic level, why does anything exist at all? On the subatomic level, you think about a single atom. What keeps a single atom from either just flying apart and no longer existing or collapsing in on itself and no longer existing? And scientists say, well, that's easy. It's strong and weak nuclear forces that do that. See, because, you know, the nucleus of an atom is made up of protons and neutrons, and protons are positively charged particles. What do even two positively charged particles do with each other? They repel, okay? So that means the nucleus flies apart. The electrons are orbiting around it. If you have positive in the middle and you have negative around it, what keeps those electrons from flying into the center and blowing up the atom? And again, scientists are like, well, what we observe as we do science, we describe it as these strong and weak nuclear forces. And I think that's awesome. That's a really descriptive way of saying we observe something and we have no idea how to explain that. Because stuff should be doing things that it's not doing. And you back up even farther, and if our universe is the product of a cosmic mishap, whereby things are exploding, how does it explode and then recoalesce at just exactly the right speed on the subatomic particle level, where it doesn't either just stay apart or implode? Many of you know the name Carl Sagan. He's one of the foremost, most respected evolutionists that's out there. And he was talking about this, and he was describing what he basically admits is inexplicable, indescribable. But he's like, but we put words to it, strong and weak nuclear forces. Do you know that the evolutionist Carl Sagan places the probability of a single living organism forming on any planet anywhere in the universe? He places the probability of that at 1 in 10 to the 2 billionth power. If you know math, that's not 1 in 10 times 2 billion, which is a really big number, but that's 1 in 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, and you do that 2 billion times, and what he says is basically, it's impossible, so why do you land there with that as an explanation? I'll show you why, because the Bible has another explanation. It's Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 6. You are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens with all their host, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them. And you preserve all of them. And the host of heaven worships you. And I think that's the punchline. If God is the owner, he created it all. He sustains it all, even on a subatomic particle level. What is the conclusion of that? God made me. God owns me. God is worthy of my worship. Fourthly, we come to what I call the power element. And I'm already talking about power in different terms. You know, if someone's going to be sovereign over something and he created it, that's awesome power. If God can sustain something on the atomic level, that's awesome power. But there's something else here in verse 18. Where Jesus is referred to as the firstborn from the dead. You see that in verse 18? And what that means is God went into death and he came back alive. And what Paul's point is, those who follow him in faith will also go into death but come back out alive, because he's just the firstborn. And there will be many other who experience the second birth after him, the resurrection power. But that's awesome power. And power is something that in our minds we can easily associate with sovereignty. You know, Maddie has this, our daughter has this little African dwarf frog. And this is one of many reasons why Mo is not the sovereign of our house. Because this little critter has absolutely no power. And you want to say, if someone's sovereign of a household, if someone's sovereign of a nation, if they're sovereign of a company, if he's going to be sovereign of our lives, he better have a power that illustrates to us his right to rule over us and to take care of us in that rule. And that's what God is showing us through the resurrection. And God has proven his worthiness to be sovereign over our lives by saying that greatest and final enemy that no person and no science and no collection of persons and wisdom, you can't conquer death. You're all going to die. I've conquered it. Follow me into that victory. And then the final and fifth basis for God's sovereignty that I see here, I call the redemptive element. And I love how this fifth element rounds out and completes and balances the first four. Because a lot of people look at the idea and they say, yes, I believe that God created. Sure, God sustains. Yes, he's got this awesome power. We're his handiwork. All those things that you just said, I believe that. But some people would say that is a terrifying or even an infuriating thought. Because you feel like his pawns. You know, he's sitting over the cosmic chessboard and he's just messing with people. And I picture little kids out in the driveway with magnifying glasses and they're scorching ants. And that's your view of God. Yes, I believe that God has the basis for this authority. I don't disagree with that. But I don't like God because I see him just scorching ants with that sovereignty that he has. And I think it's a fair question to say, okay, you Christians believe, Or maybe even I believe, and you would say this first person, maybe even I believe that God has that authority, that he has that power. But how did he use that sovereignty? How did he use that power? To dominate, to oppress, to destroy? Look at verse 20. Our text says that he used this awesome power, he used his sovereignty to make peace by the blood of his cross. Jesus was the only person, being both God and man, who had the power, who had the authority to die in your place and in my place, to say, I give myself for the sins of the world. I give myself for your forgiveness. I give myself to wash the slate clean. I give myself to reconcile you to the Father so that there's no enmity between the two parties. And friends, that is how God uses his sovereignty. And again, Acts 2, this sovereign definite plan, the foreknowledge of God that put Jesus on the cross, to what end? Just to mess with his own son, and I've heard God referred to as the cosmic child abuser. No. But to bring all his children home who follow him in faith and turn from all these other things that we could make sovereign of our lives and say, Jesus is sovereign of my life. So God is sovereign, and he has proven his worthiness to exercise that sovereignty through this redemption that has been his plan for all ages. And I hope, by the way, that this, some of this background, I hope it is encouraging and helpful to you, even before we get to some of the direct implications. Because I think a lot of times we land on a concept like sovereignty or the idea of being sovereign, and you're like, I've heard that word, I have a general sense of what it means. And maybe you didn't even understand for yourselves, why is God sovereign? Why is our God sovereign? And those are five reasons why, and I hope that encourages you. But now, let's close with a couple implications of God's sovereignty. And remember that with this final point each week, we're asking the question, so what? What difference does it make that we believe, week one, that God is knowable? Last week, that we believe God is Trinity, that he's both one and three persons in one. What difference is that going to make when I go back out into my regular daily routine tomorrow? Maybe some of you are off tomorrow. And you say, with God's sovereignty in particular, how has that guided you and comforted you up to this point? How have you fallen back into that and said, I don't understand, but I think God does? And how is that going to help you? How is that going to encourage you when you step out of here today? And before I give you these three practical implications, I have one main observation that I want to make. And that is this, that many Christians I know and talk to, maybe even most, are functional deists. You know what a deist is? A lot of the founding fathers of our nation were deists. That in many ways they had orthodox beliefs about God and who he was or is. But the idea of deism is that when he created the world, he basically then stepped away and just let it run itself. So a good illustration of deism is the cruise control on your car. Or maybe even a better one is we're about to get on a plane, is autopilot on an airplane. That you punch in, and I'm probably saying this totally wrong. I know we have some pilots and other people, but whatever. Like, just roll with me. You punch in coordinates, you're like, this is where we're going, okay? And it calculates all this stuff for, like, your wind speed and, you know, all this stuff is going on. And it makes your flaps and ailerons and rudder and all that, and it works, and you're flying the plane. And, you know, I've seen pilots get up in the middle of a flight. I'm like, oh, man, the pilot just stepped out of the cockpit, and he's in the bathroom, you know? And I have some pilot friends that are like, you know, it's very safe to fly on autopilot because the computer's brain has more stuff programmed in than a human can capture in their mind. And many people have that view of God, that it's like, well, I punch in the coordinates of, like, kind of ultimately I want history to go here. And then I just kind of walked away and I'm doing some others. Like, what is God doing? And you pray and you're like, what is God doing? Is God even listening? And you read his word and you're like, I don't understand that. And you ask him for clarity and you don't get clarity. And you're like, what is God doing? And you just feel like God is checked out because it's on autopilot, because it's on cruise control. And you would say, conceptually speaking, I believe that God is sovereign. I believe that he is preeminent. I believe that he's supreme. I believe that he has the kind of authority and power that you described this morning and the ownership of my life. But if you're asking me, do I believe that God has a plan for my life, a definite plan, and he guides every single thing that happens in my life so that it works together for good, so that I'm conformed in the image of Christ. Many of you would say, I don't see that. I don't know that I would say I believe that. And I could go into a whole series of messages why I think that is. But the short answer is because we're functional deists. Now, we would not say that we're deists, but when we come to the daily stuff of life, especially trials, we don't see a God who is guiding and sustaining every moment, or else we die. What we see is a God who's just stepped away. And frankly, some of you see a God who's as surprised as you are when some of the bad stuff happens in your life. You feel like, I never saw that coming. And your view of God is that he's like, yeah, man, me neither. But I'm here for you. But, you know, not really. I'll see you at the end of time. I honestly think that a lot of problems in the church today, I mean, the Christian church, stem from this one thing alone, that we've given God's sovereignty a vote of no confidence in our lives. I know that intellectually. I know that theoretically. Do I believe that in practice? No. And so that's the groundwork for this statement that the elders have written, which I'll share in just a moment. But I want you to think for a moment, and we're going to do this week in our gospel community groups as well. Keep fleshing this out. Don't just say, yeah, I kind of get a sense of what you're talking about. I'm not sure where it comes from in my life. I'll tell you, because when a lack of confidence in the sovereignty of God is what's in your heart, it comes poking out all over the place in situations that you did not expect. For example, complaining. Why do we complain? Why do I complain? Because at the end of the day, we don't believe that God is in control, and we have to voice our displeasure with something going on. Another example is fretting and worrying and stewing and fearful and anxious about all this stuff. And some of you even lay awake at night in your bed, and you just like your mind is racing to all these things. And it's not just that I'm wired that way where my brain doesn't shut off, but I'm not worried. And some of you are like, man, I'm very worried. What about this that's going on, like with ISIS overseas? And what if that comes to America? And what if this person gets elected instead of this person? And what about my health? And I got this kid I'm worried about. And my wife seems checked out, and my husband seems checked. And you go through all these things, and you're just anxious and worried and fretful because you don't believe that God is in control and is guiding your life and is shaping it, and that he has you. Or how about this one? You pray, but you use prayer only to tell God what you want. And it is not, Lord, as Jesus taught us to pray, Lord, I believe you're sovereign, so your will be done, your kingdom come. No, it's, Lord, there's a gap between what my life looks like and what you're allowing to have happen. So I'm going to pray now and say, my will be done, and here's what it is. And you want to be sovereign over that and tell God what he's supposed to do. Or how about this? You refuse to wait on God. God in his sovereignty is taking too much time to answer your question or bring along what his plan is for your life. So you're like, well, I'm just going to get married anyway, or I'm just going to take this job anyway. And, you know, did it seem to align with God's will? This is another way that you may not even know if it aligned with God's will, because you didn't check. You didn't talk to people, or you didn't search the scriptures and say, Lord, what is your plan? What is your agenda? What are your priorities? And may my priorities be your priorities. Or you worship your own opinions, and you just say things as if they're gospel truth, but it's not gospel truth. It's just how you feel about something. And that's a desire to be sovereign and to not trust the sovereignty of God to say, you know, like I have to do oftentimes. It's not that I agree with God on everything, but I want to. And I want to be able to say, Lord, I have this opinion about this. I'm not sure why you say it this way, but I lay down my opinions and my rights to take up yours. Or how about this? You just functionally trust something other than God. You have no confidence in the sovereignty of God, and so you hoard money. So you fight for your reputation. And I could go on and on and on describing idols that we say, functionally, at the end of the day, what do I trust? What do I depend on to make my life work? It's not God, it's this. And you fill that in. And I think if you're honest with yourselves and do kind of this self-evaluation, this sort of heart of unbelief and a lack of confidence in the sovereignty of God is really easy to diagnose, because all you're doing is just saying, is there a pattern of worry where I don't trust God to be God? Is there a pattern of complaining where what he's giving me is not good enough for me? Is there a pattern of frustration because I can't get other people to do what I want them to do? Is there a pattern of hoarding, of greed, of being tight-fisted because you rely on your financial well-being and you can't open your heart and your hand to be generous the way God has been generous with you? And again, I'm not talking about if you see an instance here or an instance there. I'm talking, do you see patterns of these things tracing through your life? Then I want you to hear this third "so what" statement. And here it is. God is the sovereign creator and sustainer of all things. Therefore, we gladly welcome his preeminence, his providence, and his provision in our lives. Preeminence. It's similar to the idea of sovereignty, right? Preeminence means above everything. Or a very simple way to think of this word that's right here in our text, Colossians 1, it means to have the first place. This is not something that we merely ascribe to God. This is something that God is. That's why I use that word. God is preeminent. Now, he may not be preeminent in your life, but he's preeminent. He's supreme. And nothing you say or do or think or refuse to believe about him is going to change the fact that he is preeminent. I love this time of year in many ways. I hate it for one main reason, which is that it's Canada geese season in Denver. Okay. And every time we take our kids out for a walk in the stroller, and we live on Central Park over here, you know, 4 billion Canada geese take off and fly directly over your heads. And I just think, look alive, because it's coming, you know, and you got to duck, dodge, dive and dart and do all that stuff to avoid getting bombarded. And I just think of it this way. There's nothing we can do to prevent Canada geese from flying over our heads. But we are not going to welcome Canada geese into our home. And my point is that there's nothing you do or don't do to make God sovereign over your life. He is sovereign over your life. The question here that I want to flesh out with you is, are we welcoming him in to our lives and saying, I don't want you to just be sovereign in a general sense that you already are, regardless of what I think of you. If you're sovereign over my life, I want to open the door of my heart and my mind and my emotions and my physical body and say, Lord, be sovereign in here. And really, it's a choice of worship. That's why I give you this word. Preeminence. God is preeminent, therefore we worship. We always worship whatever's preeminent in our life, because again, it means the first place. Whatever you give the first place to in your life, you're going to love it. You're going to talk about it. You're going to boast in it. You're going to spend your time and your money effortlessly there while you complain about spending your time and money and energy doing other things that you don't want to do that aren't first place. And here's the bottom line. You will either recognize God's sovereignty and his ownership and let him in and say, I want to worship you because you are worthy in all these ways that we've described this morning, or something else will take the first place. There are not people that don't have anything that's first place. We always have a God. We always have a Lord. It's either God who's proven himself to be worthy of that role, or something that we substitute and we counterfeit for God, like our reputation, like physical fitness, like autonomy. I just want to, what I worship at the end of the day is my freedom to do what I want to do and have pleasure. And I would suggest that you go back through these five bases of God's sovereignty and take that thing that's first place in your life right now and say, well, let's just take physical fitness because this is a very fit community and lots of people exercise. Okay. Has that become a God? Yes. Okay. And I think, okay, by nature, is that actually God? No. Was that here before me? No, because if I mean, it wasn't. It's not like a freestanding thing that's just going to continue to do its thing. Did fitness create me? Does it sustain me? Did it rise from the dead? Did it shed its blood for me? No, 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 and no. And so it doesn't deserve the first place. I'm saying usually what we do as Christians is we take good things and make them ultimate things, which is still idolatry. And it's more insidious idolatry, because if it were really, really bad, we'd probably stop doing it or at least feel guilty about it. But because it's a good thing, we don't feel the guilt and we don't let God transform our hearts to change. OK, so that's preeminence. Number two, the second word that I used there in that definition was providence. This is the idea that God guides and therefore we trust. We don't use the word providence a whole lot anymore. So let me just give you a definition so you kind of understand, make sure you know what I'm talking about. This is just from a Christian theology. By providence, we mean the continuing action of God by which he preserves in existence the creation which he has brought into being, and he guides it to his intended purposes for it. So let me give you a little bit different analogy than like cruise control or autopilot. A couple weeks ago, I just learned to snowmobile, which is really fun. But on a snowmobile, which is kind of like a motorcycle, you have a throttle that for safety purposes, if you're not actively pulling the throttle, it's not going to go. OK, and if you ease up on the throttle, it's going to slow down. If you squeeze the throttle harder, it's going to go faster. God's snowmobiling, OK, with the universe. Meaning he is actively at the helm and he is working the throttle and he is steering. And what God says is that's just simply true that I'm doing that. I invite you to hop on back and trust me. And that's kind of what it means to welcome God's providence in our lives, is that it's not just, again, this theoretical like, I trust this concept of providence, that God's in control and he's actively guiding things and my life speeds up and slows down, or that's my perception of it because he's actively doing things to sustain and work all things after the pleasure of his will. It's not mental comprehension of that. It's saying, I'm okay getting behind you on the snowmobile and riding this thing wherever you choose to take me. And we went out in Arapahoe National Forest, and you get on this on these trails and you're just cruising along and you're like, oh, this is fun, like this is like a bunny slope, and like, oh, okay, now that you're on a green and now it's blue, and then suddenly you're like, oh man, there's like a big drop off and people are taking their sleds down the big drop, or they're going up, and there's this place called what's that hill? Chicken. Yes, it's called Chicken Hill. You know why it's called Chicken Hill? Because it's very steep and you race up it on your sled as fast as you can and try to get as far as you can and try to keep enough momentum where you actually can turn and come back down rather than rolling your snowmobile over and getting crushed to death or just stalling out or something. OK, so it's Chicken Hill. OK, well, if God wants to take your life up Chicken Hill, there's a whole lot of people that are like, I'm out, I'm done. And he's like, no, hang on. This is going to be really fun. I mean, it's going to terrify you, but it's going to be awesome. And you're going to look back and be glad that you stuck with me through this. That's like God's providence. And just from a personal example, many of you know that God's providence took our family to the hospital all of last week because suddenly something is diagnosed wrong with our newborn son. And I don't say this as boasting, but I say this to say, I think this works, what I'm talking about, because I've been studying this a few weeks in advance, and we're sitting there, and his doctor is saying, okay, like the reason your son's doing all this is because his stomach is malformed and this and that, we need to do this surgery and make this cut. And you're sitting there looking at a 4-week-old baby with an IV sticking out of his head, and you're like, wait, what? You know? And you have to be pretty hard-hearted not to like have tears coming down your face of like, it hurts to see that. You know, and Marty and I were talking about this, that God's sovereignty is so good, and what he has guided into our life for right now, we had no idea that our 4-week-old had pyloric stenosis. God knew. We had no idea when we went in for surgery at 3:45 p.m. on Tuesday that he was going to have it 48 hours later because of a delay. And that delay is frustrating to us, but we're like, you know what? It did not take God by surprise. And I don't know why he wants us in here another 2 days when we both feel like we're just wasting time and not being productive. We found out one reason. We're sitting there in the surgery recovery room for infants, and this guy walks out in scrubs or whatever, and I was like, oh, hey, neighbor. And he was like, oh, hey, just a second. He went over and talked to another set of parents sitting there, and he came back over. And I was like, what are you doing here? And he's like, what are you doing here? And this is a guy that lives directly behind us that we've had a difficult time connecting with, that we've prayed for opportunities to connect with. And I was like, well, here you go. I mean, so it turns out he's one of the GI specialists who had been on our son's case without us even knowing. And he's like, oh, yeah, this little guy, this is what he has going on. And we kind of joked with him, this is going to make follow up really easy because we're just going to step across the alley and bother you, you know. My point is, I can honestly say that working on this message and kind of bathing myself in the sovereignty of God helped me. And Marty's already there. My wife is way ahead of me as far as just trusting the sovereignty of God. But it helped me pray and then just trust and rest. And people are like, you must be exhausted just laying awake fretting. I was like, no, I'm sleeping like a Calvinist. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I prayed, I entrusted it to God. And then I was like, fine, you know. Providence. God guides, therefore we trust. And then finally, provision. And this is the idea that God gives and therefore we receive with joy. And we probably don't often put it in these terms, but I think one of the reasons why we complain, why we're envious of others, like, oh, God has given you that, but I only have this. That's not fair. Or I want what she has. Or I'm not content with what I have. But if we ultimately can say, God, you are a sovereign provider, which means they have exactly what you want them to have right now, which means I have exactly what you want me to have right now, which in no way means that we don't share and are generous with one another, because that's one of God's main means in the community of faith of provision. But it means that all this worry about God's not meeting my needs and complaining about I don't have enough or I don't have enough of the right things, whether it's opportunity or work for some of you that are self-employed and you're like, well, what is going on? I don't have enough work or actual material things or relationships. God provides. God gives. Therefore, whatever he gives me, I can receive it with joy and be thankful. And as I have opportunity to share with others, great. But it doesn't mean I sit there and I'm frustrated and angry and resentful because God hasn't given what I want. So I hope in at least these three ways and continue to flesh out more. But if God is preeminent, we worship. We want him to have the first place. If God is the God of providence, guiding, sustaining actively in our lives, then I want to say, Lord, I trust you. And one of my favorite phrases, and this comes from an early church father, and I can't remember which one, but he just says, my father, I do not understand thee, but I trust thee. And how often that's true that if my goal is to understand God, why are you doing this? And why did you allow this? And what's going on here? I will never understand it. But to say, this is who you are. You are a God of providence. I don't understand, but I do trust. And then provision. God, this is what you've given to me. This is what you've given to someone else. Thank you for being a gracious provider. Thank you for giving me exactly what I need for life and godliness today. So, are you worshiping and trusting and thankful? Let's pray.